Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. You're tuned into The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics and government went wrong and how you can take action to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of personal empowerment. If you have a question or insight, call us toll-free at 1-888-268-4313 or call direct to 530-876-3222. This show is carried online, and you may also be able to get on the air in your local area. To find out if an old-fashioned on-the-air station in your area carries this show, contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for this show is up and can be found on the BBS Radio site at bbsradio.com. But you can also find out about this show from http://spiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. This show and all past shows are available to you 24 hours a day in the station archives. People continue to talk about the title of our show, since every day it seems stranger to link the words spiritual and politician. That's the point, of course. Why is our political system so out of sync with the way most of us believe we should really see others? Why do we use a system that makes doing the right thing an act of heroism instead of something we can just take for granted? The team mentality of politics in America has stolen from all of us the certainty we should have about the things that matter most, things like justice, honor, and our very rights as people. Politics has become a game, one that all decent people lose. Political parties use the strategies and tactics of war on each other and on us as Americans. All Americans need to look at politics through a new lens. America started with the idea that all of us are inherently equal and free. And that's a core truth. We are free. We're free to choose, free to live, breathe, work, and live our lives. As each of us sees fit, that's the way it ought to be. Government doesn't own us. Government is just the contractor we entrusted to perform some services on our behalf. Here at The Spiritual Politician, we remind you that contractors can be fired and held accountable. No government or politician has sovereign immunity, no matter how they dance around and insist that they do. The imperial trappings they clutch are the emperor's new clothes. On our show tonight, we will be hearing from Dr. Jennifer McLeod. Dr. McLeod will be sharing with us her lifetime experiences as an advocate for the rights of women. The doctor was one of the first women who broke through the glass ceiling to occupy a position of responsibility and power in corporate America. Her life is filled with amazing events and insights. You probably think that the whole issue of rights for women is a done deal. After all, we're now in the first decade of a new millennium. The bad news is that it's not. The rights of women have managed to secure in a campaign that lasted 12 generations and now under fire yet again. Think about that and listen to what women said when they came together to ask for those rights in 1848 in Seneca Falls, New York. The Declaration of Sentiments was written by Elizabeth Cady Stanton, the Thomas Jefferson of the women's movement. When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one portion of the family of man to assume among the people of the earth a position different from that which they have hitherto occupied, but one to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect for the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes that impel them to such a course. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of those who suffer from it to refuse allegiance to it and to insist upon the institution of a new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they were accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient suffrage of the women under this government, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to demand the equal station to which they are entitled. The document goes on to list a long train of abuses by government which denied to women their equal rights. The only change we enjoy today, which is affirmed by the Constitution and cannot be withdrawn at will, is the right to vote. All others are held at the pleasure of our legislators. Those rights include the right to control our bodies, our labor, and our own wealth. The instrument of their oppression was social policy, legislated by government, that denied their inherent rights. Katie Stanton said this about what needed to be done. Now, in view of this entire disenfranchisement of one half the people of this country, their social and religious degradation, in view of the unjust laws above mentioned, and because women do feel themselves aggrieved, oppressed, and fraudulently deprived of their most sacred rights, we insist that they have immediate admission to all the rights and privileges which belong to them as citizens of the United States. And that's where we are today. Not as much has changed as you might have thought. Our guest tonight has a very personal understanding of what those struggles have cost all of us. Dr. McLeod, thank you so much for being with us today to share your insights.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you.
And I know that you've been in this movement, you've been a feminist and active since 1969.
Right.
Could you tell our listeners something about yourself? You were born in England, right?
Right. My father was American, my mother English, and I lived in England until me and my family and my three brothers lived in England until 1940. When my father was successful in persuading my mother that we should move here because of the expected invasion of England was expected in 1940 by, of course, by our dear friend Adolf Hitler and his gang. And so we came over here in the summer of 1940, just ahead of the beginning of the Battle of Britain, the Blitz, the bombing of London, and so forth. And coming over here I was 10 years old, was a revelation to me. I had always heard a great deal about America, and from my father, who still traveled frequently to the United States. But when we arrived, I just felt the spirit of freedom, an opportunity for me as a girl. Of course, being the only girl in a family of boys, I was very conscious of that and very aware even at that age, of the great restriction on my opportunities as a girl, and when I became a woman, in English society, which was still very Victorian and very class-ridden and so forth. So I felt this is going to be good for me, and in fact it was. So we grew up, we moved around quite a bit in different communities. We were in the Midwest for a while, and then a lot of the time in Connecticut and then New Jersey, and getting a sense during the war of what American society was like. And at that time, American society was still extremely sex stereotyped, that and the laws permitted and in fact encouraged quite egregious discrimination against women, particularly in employment and in social, many, many spheres of life, education and so forth. It was really, thinking back on it now, it was like medieval times in some ways, that the status and the opportunities for girls and women was so strictly restricted, restricted.
How did you feel about that when you saw the contradiction in America between what it said about the opportunity for all and the reality?
Well, at that age and at that time, I wasn't really aware of I didn't know anything about the Constitution or American history. I was only vaguely aware of all of that. So that actually what I saw was just it was an improvement, but not a great improvement over what it had been in England.
Mm-hmm.
So that that was just the way it was. And my rebellion time was very, very muted because there was little you could do about it. However, I did know that I wanted to be a person, not just a link between generations of boys. The idea that came to me in my teens was, hey, wait a minute. I'm supposed, my only purpose in life is to grow up and to give birth to boys who may accomplish and achieve and do things for society, but I'm just sort of supposed to be a link between them. And I thought, now, wait a minute, how about me? This is very selfish concern. How about me? Why should I just be a link between generations of boys? Why shouldn't I achieve? And why shouldn't I have opportunities? And why should they tell me that, no, you can't do this and you can't do that? And why did I have to go into home economics classes and cooking and sewing in high school while the boys were doing what looked much more interesting, which was shop and carpentry and doing
And two
doing
of your brothers actually
like
are mathematicians,
that.
Right?
Yes, yes. My older brothers are both mathematicians. And but I was not expected to achieve, and they were very achievement driven by the family and by themselves, but I was simply not expected to achieve. In fact, my mother, who still feeling, well, the opportunities I have were the opportunities I would have and nothing more, she was concerned because I had what she saw as big hands and feet, and she thought I was going to be very large and therefore unattractive and would have difficulty attracting a husband.
That was your job, was to find a husband?
My job was to find a husband. And in fact, that continued well into the 60s, well toward the end of into the 70s, where almost the only opportunity for a woman to aspire to achieve anything more than what one might call genteel poverty was to find a man who would support her. Because even if she went to work in those days, she got paid little more than half of what a man would be paid, and there were almost no advancement opportunities the help wanted ads in the newspapers were segregated by sex, and you looked at the job opportunities for women, there were household help jobs, secretaries, clerks, teachers and nurses were about the only professional level jobs available. And then you went over and looked at the help wanted men, and it was management trainee, it was all kinds of interesting opportunities for men. And we would go to apply for those jobs, and we were simply turned away at the door. So it was clearly a very upsetting and annoying and distressing situation.
And you went to Columbia University.
Well,
right?
Actually, I did go to college as an undergraduate at Radcliffe College of Harvard, which in fact was academically identical to Harvard. In fact, in the upperclassmen competed in the same classrooms with the Harvard men, but our facilities were greatly much smaller, much more restricted, and lesser facilities, library facilities and so forth. We weren't allowed in the libraries. There was a special Radcliffe library which sort of had to wait for its books until the men were finished with them. And we paid higher tuition because Radcliffe didn't have the same endowment. And we were able to compete and to get that education, that Harvard education, which was very good to get. But the numbers of Radcliffe was kept at, I think, one-fifth of the student body that Harvard accepted, so that it was 5-1, or 4-1. And so that it was very clear at that point that little was expected of us. We were being educated to be appropriate wives for Harvard men and to raise their children well. It was still that sort of pattern going on.
Mm-hmm. And first time you heard the term feminist?
Probably. Well, I read in the 60s, I married immediately after college, which most of the Radcliffe women did, because there was little else that they could do that was available to them. I married immediately afterwards, but I was determined to get a graduate education and be able to support myself if ever I needed to, but more important, to be able to fulfill my own intellectual and achievement goals. So I went on to Columbia and got my PhD in social psychology, research psychology. I was one of the very few women even then at Columbia, and the undergraduate Columbia, of course, was still all male. So
really?
It was.
What year was this?
I got my PhD in 1958. So it was still very much the post-war. All the women were expected to stay home and have lots of babies at that point. The women who had worked during the war, during World War II, they had filled most of the home jobs that the troops, the military were overseas and fighting the war, and the women filled in and managed to do the jobs and do them very well. But as soon as the war was over, by law, they were required to quit their jobs and give them back to the men.
So that's another use of legislated social policy to force compliance.
Yes, you know, they were required. They had no option. And so that, of course, they, by and large, spent the 50s having babies and falling back into the stereotypical, very narrowly defined role. However, during the 50s, I was busy getting my education and then a graduate education because I simply could not go along with that. Now, you ask the question, when did I first hear the term feminism?
Mm-hmm.
Probably when I read Betty Friedan's book, The Feminine Mystique, which came out in 1963 and was an incredible eye-opener, not just for me, but for millions of women around the country, finally beginning to understand that women had been restricted unfairly and inappropriately
mm-hmm.
for all those years, and that it wasn't going to change unless and until we did something about it.
There's a lot of misunderstanding about what the term feminist means.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you can look at that, and it's very clear that there's probably a lot of intention there. Do you
yes.
have a copy of the actual definition of the word feminist?
Yes. In preparation for this talk, I looked up several words. I looked up feminism, and I have a definition from a 1966 dictionary, which would be sort of about that time. And that was the theory that women should have political, economic, and social rights equal to those of men. And secondarily, the movement to win such rights for women, which is a very, very accurate and clear description of what the word was supposed to mean. And, of course, a feminist is an advocate or supporter of feminism. And, of course, you don't need to be female.
It has to be a woman, right?
No.
A man could be a feminist.
And, in fact, there are many, many men who are feminist and actually will say they are feminist. It's in a way the actual word is a little unfortunate because it sort of suggests to people that only women can be that. But in fact, that's not the case. And very recently, just to jump ahead a little bit here, in 2001, the organization that I now head, which is the ERA Campaign Network, we commissioned a nationwide survey, properly run by Opinion Research Corporation, of attitudes of the American public today on equal rights for men and women.
Mm-hmm.
And the question was, in your opinion, should male and female citizens of the United States have equal rights?
Pretty clear.
Pretty clear.
Ambivalent.
The results, yes, 96% of the American adults say yes. And that's 95% of the men and 97% of the women.
That's amazing.
So 95% of the men, they may not call themselves feminists, but if they answer yes to that question, they are by definition feminists.
So that's amazing. And so what you're saying is really that Americans have ratified equal rights for women in their hearts and practice.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. But another question was, here's the other question. As far as you know, does the Constitution of the United States make it clear that male and female citizens are supposed to have equal rights? 72% say yes, which means they think it's in the Constitution when it isn't.
Amazing.
Yes.
Were you surprised by these
Well,
results?
I was surprised by how high both those figures were. I suspected that they would be higher than a lot of people thought, because what those questions, they're not asking, what do you think of the Equal Rights Amendment, or what do you think of the politics of the situation. They're asking the basic beliefs, underlying beliefs, and it is very heartening indeed to know that when you really get down to the basics, that both men and women in the United States believe in and want male and female citizens to have equal rights. And yet we are quite a long way from that still, in fact, because of the political, of all the political stuff that's goes on around those issues.
And there's another definition that I think we ought to hear now, because there is a term, masculinist, which people look at as being sort of the polar opposite of feminist. Do you have that definition?
I didn't look that one up, but I would assume that would mean the maintenance or the continuation or the or in fact the reinstatement of male dominance would be my guess, but I don't have a definition in front of me of that.
Yes, and actually I did look it up, and what it says is that it is somebody who works for the superior power of men.
Uh-huh, yeah.
So the fact that it's a superior power is very clear in the definition.
Yes, and feminist is not, because unless people just misconstrue the meaning of feminist.
And I think that certainly feminist is a word that has been misconstrued.
Yes, yes.
And there's a lot of evidence that that's been intentional.
Yes, and generally I prefer to use terms like equal rights advocates rather than feminist, so that to avoid that the misconstruing of the word.
Now, the way that women's rights were limited originally, at the time of the original writing of the Constitution,
mm-hmm.
was that they simply were not construed to be people
yes.
by the letter of the
yes.
law.
It's a very, very interesting. The American Revolution is so interesting in so many ways that what the colonists over here in this new continent, new to the Caucasians, that is, new
yes.
continent, saw, looked back at the old past social patterns of Europe and elsewhere, and rejected, what they were rejecting was the divine right of kings to rule, and the ruling of the people by inherited titled people, kings, royalty, and nobles, and so forth. And then the people just had to buckle under and do what they were told and were forced to. So that rejecting the divine right of kings was quite extraordinary, and the idea that the right to govern should come from the people, which was quite indeed extraordinary. But it's also quite extraordinary that while they rejected the divine right of kings, they continue to be divine right of men to rule over the women.
Well, is that really so surprising to us, though?
It's
very
not
difficult
surprising,
for
yes.
slave owners to give up
mm-hmm.
the wealth transfer that they accrue from people being held against their will.
Yes. It's not surprising because we're all creatures of our culture, and they couldn't even conceive, well, they knew, they were very aware of the problem with slavery, and they compromised on slavery in order to create the nation, because otherwise the South and the North never would have been able to get together. And one could argue a lot about, well, was that compromise really necessary, and what would have happened if they hadn't done it? But with regard to the female half of the population, they barely even thought about that. It appears that while women worked probably at least worked as hard as the men did in the revolution to make it all happen, and assumed that, hey, they were going to be free as well, and then lo and behold, they were betrayed by the founding fathers, and that was not to be. They were not really considered persons. They were still assumed to be inherently not only physically weaker, but also intellectually weaker and weaker in every other way to men, and therefore completely unsuitable for equality, to be equal of citizens, or to be able to vote, to be independent of their fathers and then their husbands. And of course, most of the founding fathers were English origin, and in England the common law was that when a couple got married, they became one, and the one was the husband. So they just continued that social pattern without really realizing that they were taking the divine right of kings and retaining the divine right of men.
That's certainly true, but America had several different, actually competing traditions there. The Quakers viewed it differently, and the Puritans, well, they, you know, also had a different view of it, because they had come from a spiritual point of view that saw all people as equal in the spirit, and that it translated in the colonial period so that women actually did exercise more autonomy, even if that wasn't necessarily ratified by the law that they had brought with them. But it's very clear, and you've taken us in that direction, that they used argumentation as a way of controlling women to ensure that they didn't go outside the role that they wanted them to occupy.
Yes, yes. And there's so the power of those social patterns and definitions were so extraordinary that the women, having been raised from babyhood to believe they were weak and not smart enough and not clever enough to do anything, to exert leadership, to create anything other than children, and being told that every day of every year, they believed it, that by and large they couldn't help but believe it, because everything told them, and their religions told them, with the possible exception of Quakers, their religions told them that women were there to serve men and to serve their children and men, and not to aspire to anything beyond that.
And that's a pretty bleak view. But let's visit for a moment the whole issue of education.
Mm-hmm.
Women certainly didn't have equal access to education.
Right.
It was very rare for a girl to be educated, even in England.
Mm-hmm.
Though dame schools started up, and many girls, including Susan B. Anthony, who was a Quaker, did get an education, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And isn't it true that it was actually the whole venue of education that eventually broke women out so that they could actually become teachers?
Well, and there, I think that in a former conversation you and I had, you pointed out, and I agree with you, that the need for teachers then required that women be educated enough to be teachers, and that started a whole trend to women becoming more educated, and the more educated they became, the more they realized, hey, look, I can do this.
The more uppity they became, right?
The more uppity
they were.
They
very
became.
Uppity.
Yes.
And but of course it worked economically, because they worked for one-third the cost of a male teacher.
So it was to the, shall we call it, the ruling class, it was beneficial to, when women began to do jobs that required education, and they did it for so much less, that it was quite understandable that the men thought, hey, this is a pretty good deal.
Yes, and from that beginning came the movement that first opened what we think of as normal schools, eventually colleges, then the medical profession, and all of the other professions that women went on to occupy, having earned their way there without with no assistance and working for much less money.
Yes. And I have to give you a personal note on the education issue. I found out when I was doing some genealogical work on my American ancestors that one of my maternal ancestors, she and her sister were living in Zanesville, Ohio, and they started a school for girls.
Mm-hmm.
And they were getting more prosperous. Their husbands were getting more prosperous because of all the opportunities in the pioneering moving west and into the Midwest. And they utilized some of that to start a school for girls. And I thought, hey, that's pretty good.
That's good a wonderful stuff. Thing to have in your background.
Yeah.
And isn't it true that what broke women out of that was the injection of the idea that this could actually benefit men so that they were willing to unleash their grasp on the venue of education because they saw it was in their best interest to do so, but it was ideas of a different way of looking at it that allowed that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually women who made those arguments, of course.
Yes, it must have been. And,
yeah.
Of course, a lot of early education went on in the home, so that the women had to at least be able to read to be able to start teaching their sons to read, and, of course, they would teach their daughters, too.
Mm-hmm. And so it was incrementally because women chose to be free. They chose to be educated.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't given them. It was something they struggled to have, even though they thought that it was something that they had believed because of the Declaration of Independence was their right.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout the women's movement, you know, moving in through time, there have been women who actually opposed the idea of equal rights for women.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And have benefited from that. We saw that during the fight for franchise in the teens.
Yes.
And now we see that today.
Yes.
And you've personally had experience with some of the women who have made their fortune doing just exactly that to other women.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's sort of a continuation of find a man or a male power and money by pleasing them, by pleasing the power structure, pleasing the men in power, and there's a way to please them by cooperating in keeping the rest of the women down, and that we've seen and still see quite a bit of that, and of course it makes us very angry.
Well, let's consider for a moment the interesting career of Phyllis Schlafly.
Uh-huh.
You've had some personal experience with her, right?
I have never actually spoken to her, but she's very much a figure, of course, in all the women's movement in the 70s when I was very heavily involved in all kinds of actions in the 70s. And she was fighting the Equal Rights Amendment tooth and nail, and on the argument, basically what her argument was that women are indeed inferior and weaker and not as intellectually strong as men, and therefore they have to be protected and coddled and taken care of by men, which is saying, hey, you know, we really can't do it ourselves. Therefore, again, back to the old pattern where you've got to find a man who will give you the standard of living that you would like to have. And that view, that when she espoused it, of course, was a great benefit to the powers that wanted to keep the sex segregated pattern because it was economically beneficial to them.
And it was economically beneficial because
yes.
Corporations really do prefer to pay women less.
Well, in the 70s, what stopped the Equal Rights Amendment from being added to the Constitution during that time, what prevented it from being ratified by the full 38 states necessary, was that corporations, large corporations, which in those days were the very, very dominant, they still are, but they're different corporations now, but very, very dominant, but they based their entire economic strength and profit on vast numbers of vastly underpaid women.
So you're saying it was a sort of a substitution for the southern plantation system?
Well, in a way, yes. You know, the Jefferson didn't see how he could afford his Monticello without the
slaves.
General Motors and all the big AT&T and all the big companies didn't see how they could possibly maintain their corporations and their profit structure and their future without the vastly underpaid women who worked for them.
So it's just, it's gradations of exactly the same sort of strategy.
It's the same.
So slavery isn't dead in America.
Well, it's in that sense now. The quote slavery of women was always was quite different from the slavery of the enslaved black people, but in the mechanism was similar, was quite similar. So
well, actually, but they didn't have the capital upkeep of the women.
Mm-hmm.
They paid them, but then they went away.
Mm-hmm. And it was interesting because and this still holds to or has held till very recently, was the women had to get themselves educated and trained for the jobs before they were hired.
Well, yes, and of course,
whereas
they had to,
men
they had
could
to train
take
their
the
own
jobs
slaves.
and get paid and get trained on the job at the expense of the corporation. You know, the women secretaries had to get their secretarial training and their shorthand and their typing on somehow on their own nickel or their father's money. And then they would be hired, but always on a temporary basis on the assumption that as soon as they got married, they would quit.
Mm-hmm.
So that they might work for 2, 3, 4 years, but there was no need to give them raises or any on-the-job training or give them any opportunities because they were going to leave.
And so they were going to be cycled through and then utilized again to create babies that would then produce the next generation.
Yes. Yes.
That they really didn't want to have change.
That's right. That's right.
And so we have this whole sort of little cadre of women, and you'd probably take a look at Schlafly and say that she was the most prominent of like the 50s, 60s generation. And then mm-hmm. in this generation, we have such women as Ann Coulter, who's actually said that women shouldn't even have the right to vote, and Wendy McElroy, who's done everything she can to deny women the mm-hmm. right to freely contract in marriage by demanding that the government continue to do that as a wealth transfer to men,
uh-huh.
giving them control they wouldn't otherwise have. And she's a woman who's actually purports to be a libertarian, which is sort of amazing. And McElroy actually now works on Fox News. She got a gig there. Coulter is a multi-millionaire.
Mm-hmm.
And Schlafly, of course, as we all know, is a multimillionaire.
Yeah. Well, it was an economic good deal for them to be co-opted by the power structure and then rewarded for helping the power structure keep women, the vast mass of women, down in underpaid and with lack of opportunity to escape.
Mm-hmm. And that's really what we're confronting today. We still have this cadre of women who create kind of covering fire, a facade, mm-hmm. Producing arguments that make it look like women don't need the ERA.
Mm-hmm.
But you're one of the founders of the ERA Campaign Network.
Yes.
Could you tell us about that and about the work you're doing?
Yes. Well, we founded the ERA Campaign Network just back in 2000 because there was a change in the in the legal situation for the Equal Rights Amendment. In 1982, the original time limit that had already been extended 3 years expired for ratification, and everybody thought that the ERA, Equal Rights Amendment, was dead. And, of course, the Equal Rights Amendment is very, very simple. Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. Very simple, straightforward. And what the Equal Rights Amendment would do in the Constitution is establish once and for all and permanently that America stands for equality of the sexes. We still don't have it. We founded the ERA Campaign Network as a network of people across the country working to complete the ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment by the addition of just three more states. We had 35 states ratified in the 70s, and there are just three more needed. That's three-quarters of the 50 states. So we have created a network of coordinators. There are some 35 coordinators now around the country, and working, and then some of them, many of them working in the unratified, the not what we prefer to call the not yet ratified states, and there are 15 of them, and the working
to. What are those states? Could you tell us?
The states, okay, I've got them memorized, but I'm going to pull out a list so I don't miss it.
We want to make sure it's accurate.
Yeah, and probably because I'm on the radio show, I'll forget something. So hold the line just one moment while I pull out the list. Here we are. Alabama, Arizona, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Illinois, Louisiana, Mississippi, Missouri, Nevada, North Carolina, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Utah, and Virginia.
And do we see a trend?
There are more southern states, obviously, there. And then if you look at a map, you can sort of see the grouping. And they are largely the states that were originally slave states. But with the exception of Illinois, and Illinois is particularly interesting because Illinois was just about to ratify in the 70s when suddenly the powers that be, including Phyllis Schlafly, who I believe lived in Illinois at the time, really went to town, and there were two or three legislators who had sworn to vote yes, who then voted no, and we will never know exactly what it was that made them vote no, but, follow the money comes to mind.
Well, that's certainly always a factor, isn't it?
Yes, so what we're now working, there's a lot of very promising work going on. Illinois, there are actually very high hopes that ratification will be completed in Illinois late this year or early next in the November session of their legislature.
That will be fantastic.
Well, in the last session, their House of Representatives overwhelmingly a bipartisan ratification, but then it had to be ratified in the Senate, and the people working for it were not sure that they thought they had the votes, but didn't want to put it to a vote, because obviously a no vote is worse than a vote of no is worse than not having a vote. So Illinois is very promising. Another one that's very promising is Arkansas. Their legislature does not meet this year, but the preparation and it looks very promising that next spring they may well ratify.
And that would be two.
And Florida is an absolute cauldron of activity with tremendous support for the ERA, hundreds of organizations, newspapers, townships, councils, and so forth are supporting ERA ratification in Florida. So Florida might just
ratify.
Not this year, probably, but maybe next.
And so there really is a lot of hope.
Yes.
If you could tell your, there was something that you wanted to tell your granddaughter or leave to your granddaughter, what would that be?
Melinda?
Yes?
We have a program that's starting here in 1 minute or 30 seconds. Well, I know we started 7 minutes after the hour, but we have a live show coming in about 1 minute.
Okay.
You better finish up, Melinda, then.
Okay, well, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Bye.
Bye. On this show and every subsequent show, I end with a reading of the mission statement of America. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, and that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. And this is the message that the Declaration of Independence brings us. And this is the message that we need to remember, because this is a mission that is not yet fulfilled. This is a war that is not yet won. Sometimes we are moved to act for the country we love. Sometimes we're moved to act for the children that we've had or the grandchildren that we know that we're going to have. Sometimes we do what we do simply because we know in our hearts and down into our souls, it is the only thing that we can do because it's right. I want to thank Dr. McLeod for being with us again today. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless you and your family, and may God bless and protect America. Good night.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.